You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
Yes, which way, what, when, how? Mr. Otto D, flip the track right now.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in on this lovely Monday evening here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Doniolo, broadcasting live from Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Network Studios, high above Camelback Road. And my guest on the Otto D Show this evening is a man who is a singer, songwriter, and a guitarist with a little bit of Clapton in his blood. Mr. Bill Garvin will be joining us right after this song called Dead in the Water from the Fervor Records catalog.
Live.
And that was Dead in the Water from Fervor Records recording artist Bruce Knoll and his album entitled The Narrow Road here on the Otto D Show, which is brought to you this evening by Fervor Records and Fauna Films. Check out Fervor at fervor-records.com and Fauna Films at fanna-films.com. And so without further delay, let me welcome to the show guitarist, singer-songwriter, Bill Garvin. Bill, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite lovely. How are you, Otto?
I'm doing well. I heard your GPS gave you a hard time on the way here.
I don't use GPS. I'm a little too old school for that.
Okay.
And I got turned around.
You got a paper map out at the Circle K and put it on the hood of the car.
That's pretty much it.
Oh, that's where I'm supposed to be. Well, listen, did you do anything exciting for Memorial Day weekend?
I escaped the crowds. I was up in the mountains.
Where'd you go?
And then up out of Payson.
Okay.
And then got out of there right before the crowds hit, came back and chilled where nobody is. Everybody leaves town. So I come back.
That's awesome. And then how often do you get out of town?
This time of year, constantly.
As often as you can?
Constantly, yeah. My business allows me to take about 6 months off a year.
Perfect.
And I travel a lot.
Perfect. Sounds like a good gig. We'll have to get into that. But before we do, I noticed that you brought a friend along with you today, a man I know well, guitarist Simon PC Frost. So tell me, how did you manage to link up with the likes of this crazy Englishman?
Through another crazy Englishman.
That's right, Mr. Pickering.
Yeah, Paul Pickering.
Who's Paul?
Who's Paul? Paul's a multi-instrumentalist that plays around quite a bit and hosts some really great jam sessions. I met Paul through Malin Hawk, I believe. Malin played with me quite a bit and, you know, brought Paul down to hear me one day, and we became pretty close friends. And then I met another crazy Englishman.
So he was playing with Paul that day?
Yeah, I actually met Paul through the great Buzz Fowler, the long-lamented, lovely man. Who never forgot a name, never forgot a face. Extraordinary for bringing people together. And I met Paul, probably about 6 or 8 years ago. And ended up jamming with him that night at a blues jam, and we stayed friends ever since.
Cool. Well, Bill, you may not know, but the last time I hung out with this guy was in L.A., at the NAMM show, actually.
Mm.
And so it's been a few years.
Helped me back to my room more than once.
Somebody has to do it. You know? But we had a really nice time. I had a lot of fun. And I'm going to talk to you more, Simon, at another day. We're going to dive into some of your stories. But feel free to throw in, you know, into the conversation as much as you like. I'm interested in getting an opportunity to dig into Bill's life here a little bit. And, of course, all of us, I think, can toss in our references to Clapton, because that's kind of one of the things that's all about your music. You do this tribute show to his music, really, Eric and the Dominoes. Tell me a little bit about how that came about.
Well, I was doing a solo act and doing quite a bit of Clapton material. And then some of my fans, a lot of my fans become my friends over the years.
Sure.
And this one lady kept asking me, play Over the Rainbow. Can you play Over the Rainbow? And I looked at her and said, I'm not a singer. That's a singer song. I can't do that. But then one day they invited us over to their mansion and played this Clapton DVD where he closed the show with Over the Rainbow. And with his arrangement, I said, oh, I can do that. And I love this DVD. And Clapton is not my favorite guitar player. He's maybe in the top 10. But he is my favorite artist because of his material. His material is just, I mean, you've got 6 decades of wonderful songs. And people started bugging me, saying, Bill, you do so much Clapton. People would come in and see my show and say, you know, we paid $75 to go see Clapton last month. We should have come to see you. You know, it would have saved us a lot of money. So I gathered some friends together and started doing Clapton.
So how long have you been doing the show that's focused on the Clapton music?
It's about 5 years now. About 5 years now with some really wonderful musicians.
Mm-hmm. Who's in the group?
Currently, I've got John Varro on keyboards. He's a Berklee graduate. I've got Tiana Riccardi on background vocals, who does a lot of solo shows herself. My wife, who is new to the music industry, but is blessed with a great voice.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Remley, who's a master drummer.
Joe Drummer.
Yeah, man, the guy is an animal. He does a Kansas tribute that is out of this world.
Awesome.
You know, that's difficult stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Darwin Scott is the latest addition. He plays with a lot of people, and Darwin's just wonderful bass player.
Mm-hmm.
Another cool man I met through Buzz Fowler.
Yeah, and I met Darwin through these jam sessions that both Paul and this guy, Simon, they really host some wonderful jam sessions once or twice a year where you get to meet the cream of Phoenix's musicians.
Cool. And then coming up, you've got a big show this Saturday.
Yes, and you're opening for it. I'm so excited.
Yay! I know. It's going to be fun. I was excited to get the invitation from Victoria to open the show, so that was a blast.
Yeah, we'll be playing at BLK. I have not been there yet, but it looks like...
You haven't been there.
I have not been there.
But you're going to have a great time.
Looks like a really phenomenal
venue.
It's a great venue.
We should take a drive up after the show.
You really should. Actually, Monday, they're closed on Mondays.
This is Tuesday.
Oh, I forgot. I always do my show on Monday because of the holiday, of course. Do the days always go in that order? I can't get
they
hang of that.
They have for a while now.
So yeah, go after the show. It's a really cool spot. And outside, you know, they have an inside bar where they put bands, you know, smaller space. But then they have this big stage outside, a concert stage, where they bring in a lot of groups. In fact, the night before we're there, I think Fuel is there the night before our show. Yeah. And they have this massive swimming pool outside and cabanas all around it so that you can actually rent a cabana with a big screen TV in it and watch the show from there.
Very Vegas.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's very Scottsdale.
Yeah,
and the food's great. Yeah, it's very uptown, but
right,
it's a nice
place.
Right
in the middle of the airport.
Yeah, I know. Right.
Bizarre.
I know. So, but it's going to be a lot of fun. I think one of the reasons is they can make a lot of racket over there because it's an outdoor venue stage, you know, and so it gets loud.
And it will.
Yeah. I plan on playing very loud.
Good, good. That's good. That's exciting. I plan to play as loud as I can.
I plan to play louder.
Okay. So now Simon's actually playing with you at this show, correct?
Yes.
He's in your band. Is this a one-off for Simon, or is he a new addition, or what's the deal?
We'll see.
So at least it's the first time.
This is the first time.
So you got to pass the grade then, huh?
Yeah, Simon and I have played. Fairly recently, we did a large show, and I brought in a guest artist, a friend of mine, Mike Torres, who does a phenomenal Santana. His tribute is called Evil Ways, and he plays all over the country with that.
Cool.
And I thought, you know, I love Mike. I've never had the opportunity to play with him,
right.
So I thought, let's bring him on stage for a couple of songs. And then Victoria Richards, who has set up this BLK gig, said, you know, that went so well with Mike. Why don't you do that with Simon? You know?
Cool.
And I thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense because there's a couple of songs that really need that second guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah, the live Clapton arrangements. I mean, Andy Fairweather, low, I've got to tread very carefully in his footsteps. The guy's an absolute solid maestro with that stuff.
He is.
And so, I've got my work cut out, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Cool. Well, it's a lot more fun as a guitarist when you're taking the solos and you're playing rhythm. When you quit playing rhythm and go to solo guitar, it's kind of...
Things drop out a bit.
Yeah, you want to feel that support.
You know what? This band is so solid that it's a joy for me that I can actually stop playing and the band still sounds really, really good.
Yeah.
You know, I can just float on top if I want to. Mm-hmm. It takes the pressure off so much.
Well, now, how much do you prefer singing over playing?
Oh, I've always been a player first. You know, I've been in bands where they told me to shut up and stop singing, you know, but I've gotten a little bit better over the years. Luckily, Clapton is not necessarily known as a virtuoso singer.
Right.
So I do much better on the guitar than on the vocal. I enjoy singing.
Mm-hmm.
I do. But guitar playing is where it's at for me.
Well, you sound a bit like him when you're doing the songs. I mean, you have the same range and same type of voice. So.
Right. Like I said, he can't sing either.
Well, that's one way to look at it. You know, in fact, that's funny because I have done and do on occasion a John Lennon tribute show. And John was never thought of as the greatest singer either, you know. But one of the things that he was really great at was screaming. And I was never a screamer. And so I have learned to scream a lot. And that's been fun to learn to scream. And in fact, in the show...
But you have to be careful.
Yeah. It's the last song of the night. Yeah. But we're going to... This is a top secret. Don't tell anybody. But we're going to end with Dizzy Miss Lizzy, which is an old track of theirs. That you really just scream the whole time. And I just love screaming. So it's going to be fun to do that last.
Did we pass the audition?
Exactly. Then if they go one more, I'm like, sorry. Bill's going to come up now. So that'll be a lot of fun. Well, listen, when did you start playing? How old were you when you started playing guitar?
Let me see. I did my first professional gig when I was 10 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
For money.
Yeah, I was in the Tommy Galindo Trio. He was our music teacher. Tommy wasn't in the band. We were in novelty.
What town were you in? Where was this?
Was Modesto, California.
Okay.
We had a six-year-old drummer.
Cool.
And we were a novelty act.
Uh-huh.
I'll bet.
So we played Elks Lodges and that kind of thing, you know. And I thought, 10 years old, I'm making money. This is pretty cool.
Wow.
And by 16, I was playing in bars because I had a really good fake ID.
Mm-hmm.
So there I was in bars playing with these impossibly old people that were like 30.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why are you still playing music type old, you know?
Yeah. you haven't made it yet. But I'm playing with these guys that are like 30. And some of them are like already raging alcoholics. And they're traveling and they're having this hard life. And I decided I didn't want to do music, but I loved it so much that I always, always kept playing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was, I don't know, about 35 or so, I finally went full time. My life changed. I made some decisions. I decided that I didn't really need money anymore, or as much money at that point in time, and auditioned for the best band in town. In Fresno at that point, and got the job and toured with them.
Cool.
So,
and have you been part of an ensemble that had a recording contract at any time?
That band before I joined it, that was Larry Keyes. Before I joined it, yeah, they had a recording contract. Okay. That all blew up.
Of course, those are the great stories.
You know,
that's what they do. They're like bombs; they blow up.
Yeah. Larry had like 3 CDs out and some really good stuff. But by the time I joined the band, he was just, you know, doing the honky-tonks and festivals around the West.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to play some of your music. When was the first time that you got into a recording studio?
Well, the recordings that I've done have always been self-recorded because the technologies these days just astounding. And these recordings that you'll hear, actually there was zero collaboration. I'm a little bit of a control freak.
Mm-hmm.
And every noise that you hear on there was either played by me or programmed by me.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else had their hands in there. You know, there's pros and cons to that.
Sure.
You know, but I've always felt uncomfortable telling somebody, you know what, that wasn't what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're dealing with a computer, you can just, the computer has to obey you.
That's true. It does what you tell it to do.
Yeah. So I don't know when I first started doing that. I first started recording. Oh, geez. I remember having a Teac A3440.
I had one of those too. Absolutely, man. That's kind of what I started on.
And just yesterday, I was looking for some stuff, and I found an old reel-to-reel that still has some early efforts from when I was like 16.
Mm-hmm. I have a reel just like that and no machine to play it on.
No machine. It would scare me to death to put that actually on.
But that's why you don't
machine.
Play it, because you remember it so fondly. Yeah. You know? This was great.
This was great with my stuff. Porter Studio Masters, man. I gotta tell you.
Yeah, then when you finally listen to it, you're like, well, I thought, okay, fine. But yeah, I've got a box of reels, about 4 reels, a quarter inch, 4 track from the Teac 3440. That was a great little machine.
It was. It really was. It was groundbreaking.
Yeah. In fact, when I bought mine, it's I really think it's one of the reasons why I ended up in the recording business for so long, because I didn't buy it to go into recording. I bought it as a musician, like thinking, you know, I can play a guitar, then I can actually play something else, and then I can sing a thing, and I can work up these songs. But the first thing I did with it was record the radio, like testing it out. And so I recorded a bit of a song and stopped, rewound, and played it back. Wow, it worked really well. So if I hit record now, it's going to actually erase it, right? So I hit record again. And there's another song that came on. So then when I played it, I heard a song cut and another song, just, you know, like an edit. And the two sounded so different. I'd never noticed that songs kind of sounded different in terms of their sonic qualities, because I'd never listened to music like that. And the second song was Sugarloaf's Green-Eyed Lady. And it was so clean and clear. And the song where you could hear the kick drum pedal squeak nearly, you know, everything was so in your face. And the song before wasn't like that. And it made me go, why?
Interesting.
Then I dove into recording because I thought, a friend of mine made a record at a local studio and I thought it sounded bad compared to hit records. So I thought, well, there must be a thing. There must be
something to this.
It's not just the guy playing. There's the guy making the record is either screwing it up or making it better. And so that's really what got me into it, is that buying that machine and recording the radio, which is an odd thought.
Yeah, well, you know, if you go see anybody live, the sound man, if they're using a sound man, hopefully they are, the sound man has He's got the hands of destiny. He can make you or break you.
Oh, iconic.
The hands of destiny. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And that's the sad thing, I think, in the old days, in the big tours, is that the opening band didn't have they wouldn't let him have control of the sound. In fact, I saw a show once in the opening tour night with Genesis, and I forget the opening band, but the main house EQs were turned off for the opener. And then in comes the sound guy. He can't figure out what's going on. And then when the main guy comes up, he throws one switch and poof, the PA is beautiful.
Wonderful, yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want the first band to sound too good.
No, it is down to the sound guy, though, isn't it? I mean, we did a show in Vegas with Gervitz, and the sound check was like nearly 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It was just grueling. And eventually we'd argued the toss with this guy over what was going to go where. When we opened for REO Speedwagon last year, we played a song and a bit, and it was just nailed. Mm-hmm. Their sound guy is virtuoso. I don't know who was working that board, but he was doing it. But it really is. The sound guy really can.
And I think when you're on stage and it sounds great.
Oh, it's all so the inspired. Difference in the world. All the difference in the world.
Yeah.
You're, as a guitar player, you're endlessly chasing tone, endlessly, you know, tweaking this. I was doing it today. I'm working tones for the show on Saturday. I was still working on some tones. Lately, though, we've gone to a complete Bose system, and it makes life so easy because that system sounds good everywhere with no EQing at all. Maybe you add a little bit of bass, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Inside, outside, no matter what room you play, that system sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, you won't be using that on Saturday.
No.
They'll have a much bigger system
outside.
Well, listen, I want to play a cut of yours called Jacob's Girl.
Cool.
So tell me anything you'd like to tell me about that particular track.
Well, it was inspired by a friend, this lady that I knew, that it's a very common human condition. A lot of us are just never satisfied with our lot in life, and that's what it's about.
Cool. And when was this song cut? Do you recall?
What do my notes say? 2005.
Hey, I'm like, why remember anything that you can look up? There's no room for that. All right, cool. Well, let's check out Jacob's Girl by Bill Garvin here on The Otto D. Show.
Thank you.
And that was Jacob's Girl by Bill Garvin here on the Otto D Show from the album called Jacob's Girl, which
title
is
track, baby.
Yeah, which is available in the marketplace. You can pick it up at iTunes, I imagine.
Pretty much any place I could put it. I haven't sold a lot of copies of that, mostly overseas. Most of the copies have been sold in Finland, which interestingly has the highest per capita rate of suicide.
So you're the one killing all those people.
I deny any correlation.
Okay. But you're selling a lot in Finland. That's interesting. And then are available on your website, or would you direct people to iTunes if they were interested in buying your stuff?
Either way. Okay. Either way.
And what is your website?
BillGarvin.com.
And Garvin is spelled G-A-R.
V, as in Victor, I-N.
Perfect. Okay. Well, BillGarvin.com, and that was Jacob's Girl. We'll play some more in a minute. But I was reading on your bio that you were inspired in part by your father, who played cowboy jazz.
Yeah, and interestingly, on that song, all that slide guitar that you hear, that's my dad's Montgomery Ward's guitar.
Awesome.
It's a horrible, horrible guitar. I tried to play it when I was a kid. It was impossible. The strings are about 4 inches off the fretboard.
Right.
But you mic it up and play a slide on it, and it's got a really cool, unique tone.
Very interesting. I had one of those first Sears guitars. What were they called? The
Silver
Tiesco
tones.
Del Rey or something.
Oh, Tiesco. Tiesco, yeah.
Tiesco
Del Rey, yeah. It's kind of funny, but you got to start on something.
Yeah, you do.
Now, what about your dad? Did you ever see him play out?
No. As a matter of fact, he never saw me play until I was about 52 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, even though I was a professional musician, and he always told me, I'd ask him for lessons, ask him to show me something, and he'd say, I don't know what I'm doing. And finally, once when I was around 50, I got to play with him, and he did know what he was doing. He used to play, I don't know if you're familiar with this style of music, cowboy jazz, Bob Wills and the Texas Playboy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're playing inversions all up and down the neck and doing this stuff. Maybe he didn't know the names of what he was doing, but he was actually very good, but he didn't want to show me.
Right. He just didn't like you then. Is that what you
He was a busy man. Yeah.
And a lot of people don't have the patience to teach.
Right.
And he probably didn't want to sit there and have to try to explain it. You'd ask questions he wouldn't have the answers to, and it just wasn't worth it.
And he supported my music in other ways. Mm-hmm. He allowed the band to practice at our house.
Awesome.
He bought me my first couple of three guitars.
Mm-hmm.
So there was support.
I mean, guys got in the band back in the day if they had a place you could rehearse. You're really bad, but we can practice at your house? Yeah. You're in. I remember doing that with a couple guys.
Yeah, I mean, to the point where one time I had this was very early. I was maybe 17 or something, and I had a keyboard player. Well, his dad wouldn't let his keyboard out of the house. My parents allowed me to take our upright piano to gigs. So we would get a furniture dolly and mic that sucker up.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
The stuff that we used to do.
I know. We used to haul, Hammond B3 and Leslie's around. And,
oh, my God.
And it's just,
so did
why?
I.
Why? Those were the days. And we built homemade drum stages and risers that would fold up, and we'd have more junk to bring.
We still do that.
Yeah. Still, there you go. And, we used to make, back in the day, you made our own light shows out of coffee cans and fluorescent bulbs. You probably did, or like the little spotlights, Flash pots out of 2x4s.
We had a 7-foot robot with flashing
lights.
Yes.
Wow.
That we would take to gigs just as a stage prop. Yeah, why? Because it was there.
It was cool. That's awesome. That is crazy. Then you continued to play guitar through college. In fact, you gave guitar lessons yourself.
Oh, yeah. In high school and through college, I kind of supported myself by teaching in music stores, mm-hmm. which is a wonderful way to learn more about the guitar, because you have to analyze, why am I doing this, mm-hmm. in order to communicate that to somebody. Mm-hmm. So it's teaching is a wonderful way to learn.
Yeah, I found that as well. What's your favorite type of music to play? If you're just playing guitar with someone and showing them guitar, what do you enjoy the most?
Blues, baby. If it mm-hmm. ain't got blues, it doesn't touch me. Mm-hmm. It's gotta have, even if it's a pop song, it's got to have some blues in there somewhere, or it doesn't have emotion for me. Mm-hmm. So
what kind of stuff do you like to listen to? I mean, what inspires you when you're listening?
I don't listen to music. I'm a very strange musician. I go out in the desert and listen to the wind blow. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, when I do listen, my favorite guitar player is Robin Ford, because he brings a jazz influence into the blues. And then Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know, just the touch. I mean, I've studied those guys a lot and incorporated. And of course, you know, Clapton too. Mm-hmm. He's mm-hmm. kind of the basis of all of that. Mm-hmm. I can't say I've really studied Clapton's guitar playing so much, except that all of my favorite guitar players wouldn't exist if it weren't for him and his influence, and a handful of other people mm-hmm. like him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fact.
You know, when you watch the really great guys play like that, I mean, Stevie Ray Vaughan makes it look like he's not playing anything difficult. You know,
the guy's playing on 13s, for heaven's sake.
He makes it look like he's just schlepping off and having fun, and anyone can do this. Come along, just do it, you know. But man, the guy was incredible.
Dude, played a cheese grater. He used to leave fingertips all over the stage.
Yeah, and see, I did that for a while. I was playing 12s, mm-hmm. you know, on my custom made Strat. And I simply don't play enough anymore, because you got to have some muscles. You got to have some finger strength to play 12s. Yeah. You know, I'm down to 9s now.
Yeah. You know? Why not?
I'm gonna butt in and take a 2-second chance to give a mention to a dear friend who needs to be mentioned here, is Jerry Donahue.
Okay.
Fabulous musician who got sick a couple of years ago and lost the ability to play. But through him, I play on a light set of strings, and I bend 3 strings in 3 directions the best way I can, all based on the Donahue style. And it seems that there's 2 schools of thought. You have the heavy strings and the light strings, and I'm a girly. I play the light ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I came up more as a bass player before I started really spending a lot of time on guitar. So if I use 9s, I'll never be in tune, because my left hand grabs it like a boom, you know?
Yeah, I was a bass player.
Well, you need to use John Pierce strings, plug.
So I go, yeah, there you go. So I play 10s, because then I can still play pretty well and not pull the guitar out of tune all the time.
Yeah, there is that danger. You know, you have to be more precise with lighter strings. And I can overbend sometimes, or even pull a chord out of tune.
That's what I would do more than anything with 9s. Just grab the chord so hard that it just wouldn't be in tune. And you think your guitar's out, but if you just let go a little, it's fine.
Yeah.
Just get too excited, you know, when you're playing. So that's kind of a tough
spot. I always tune about 10 cents flat, because I pull so hard on it behind the frets.
Now, Simon, you have had a style of pulling to emulate a steel guitar, pedal steel guitar. Is that the 2 and 3 string stretching you're talking about?
Yeah, it's stealing from guys like Adrian Legg and Jerry Donahue, who are absolutely masters of doing something that isn't completely allowed.
I mean,
even when I do, there are some great musicians in the Valley who invite me to go out and play jazz gigs, because I chunked 4 with a big band for about 4 years. And so I can read a bit, and I get dragged into some of these jazz gigs, and I'll find myself playing Misty, and I'll be bending the hell out of it.
That's the way I do it.
Yeah, that's how it's done, isn't it? Goes up to 11.
That's how we do it, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, you play regularly with Paul Gerwitz.
That's correct.
And Paul's been on the show, but he's at home recuperating.
He got a little sick too, he's perky now.
He's doing well?
Yeah, if he wanted everybody to know about it, he would have told them already.
Oh, so I should just shut up.
Yeah,
so,
shut up.
So you are going out with him again this summer. You've got some dates coming up.
I think we've got some stuff coming up. I'll leave Paul to publicize that, because, you know, if you talk about a gig before it's planned, you end
up putting
the mockers
canceled
on it. Yeah. So, but cool. Yeah, I'm really excited to play some more with Paul. It's great. We do... we do a show with him that's basically the history of his career. He had his first professional gig in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
So with Gene Vincent, of all people.
Awesome.
And
how cool is that?
He ended up doing very, very well in not only playing with the likes of Ginger Baker and Brian Parrish and some fabulous musicians, but also in writing and production and performance, and even appearing in the film Tommy as
kind of
played
cool.
vocals to that.
Yeah, and so, it's interesting. He's got an interesting story, his background. You know, just when you grow up in that environment, if you were a musician in the early 60s hanging out in London, England, like he said, you could just turn and anywhere and there's somebody.
Oh, know? Yeah.
Because everybody in that community kind of blew up all kind yeah, of all at the same
it's wild,
time.
Isn't it? I nearly pretty killed wild. Brian Ferry on a pedestrian crossing one day. I mean, it's that easy.
It'll happen. You know, you've got a great voice for radio.
Why, thank you so much. I've done it before.
You have, really?
Absolutely.
Well, you were on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
Like, no, like for a job.
Well, kind of.
Tell me.
It was in the days of pirate radio in the UK.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we had a land-based pirate station which involved a battery cassette machine, a car battery, an inverter, and a homemade transmitter, and a wire that was strung up between two trees, and we were broadcast for hundreds of miles with this stuff.
Oh, that's rock and roll.
There was in fact,
I've never
there
heard
was
that story.
Pirate radio with a car battery.
That's right.
No, that's how it all
completely
happened.
Completely mobile.
Don't worry, we can do this.
It was anybody have a car
incredible,
battery?
And you'd have four guys at the corners of the field. And they'd be looking on the lookout for the Home Office, who were representing the broadcast authorities in the UK at that
wow.
time. And they'd drag the cops along, and somebody would grab the battery, somebody would transmit it. You just scatter like
that's crazy.
Ants.
That's interesting. Crazy. How long were you doing that? Summer or something?
I think the last time I got arrested for that was 1978. it's funny, when my wife and I went to the UK in June of last year.
That's how we measure things. Last time I got arrested for that.
Oh, we can't really mention criminal records at this point.
Well, I'm going to drop a name. Cause
it's rock and roll.
when we last went to the UK in June last year, we ended up in Brighton and met up with a guy who was on the same summons.
Same
court summons.
Okay.
Nick Mallinson, God bless him, who now runs the community radio on the south coast of England.
Wow.
And so just a couple of years ago, I had a chance to do a few jingles for him, and it was
kind of a neat reconnect.
Huh? Yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's get back into Bill and your career playing music and Eric Clapton's music. When you start to do a tribute like that, I don't believe in natural segues. I just force them in there. when you start to music like that, you really do have to learn some stuff you don't know because maybe you didn't know some songs. You got to beef up the Clapton catalog a little. So you do really start to discover them.
Right.
And you mentioned to me, already in the show, you mentioned that the thing that impresses you the most is the body of work.
Right.
And I'm kind of like, really? I can think of three or four big hits. And then I think of him as a guitar player. And his voice, I think, is pretty cool. So how did your impression of Clapton transition as you started to kind of prepare and study for that show a little more?
Well, the first concept was I was going to replicate this DVD that I fell in love with.
Ah, okay.
So we learned, and because the DVD was very representative of his body of work, there were songs on there from Cream, from Blind Faith, mm-hmm. from his solo career,
right.
You know, which his solo career is pretty freaking amazing. But there's the back story for those bands as well. And he's still doing yeah. Sunshine of Your Love and,
I know, what a
you
song.
Know, and Badge and all of those tunes. So we took that CD or that DVD as our milestone, and we did every song just like that DVD. They're different arrangements. They're not like the originals.
Right.
Because one of the really cool things about Clapton's music, some of these songs he's been playing with some of the world's best musicians for 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of those musicians have left their own stamp on these songs. The songs have changed. The songs have improved
mm-hmm.
over these 50 years. So we took this DVD, analyzed it, dissected it, got into our own recording studio and started nailing these songs, recording 19 tracks and listening back for mistakes so that we knew we were getting it right.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went out and performed this and found out that's not what people want. They want to.
And
they
that, don't matters? Hear, that matters?
They don't want to hear a concert that Clapton would do.
Right.
They want to hear nothing but the hits.
Right.
They want to hear nothing but the hits. You go to hear a Clapton show, he's going to throw some obscure stuff in there.
Yeah, he's going to play music.
You know? But a tribute band, you better play every song that they're expecting to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to learn more songs.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the advantage with Clapton's music is so well documented that we had the advantage of being able to pick the very best version of I Shot the Sheriff, in our opinion. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, the version that we do, we've cobbled together pieces from three different versions.
Oh, okay.
That we all thought were dramatic. This is a really cool dramatic part they did at this concert in Madison Square Garden in 1983,
mm-hmm.
right? With Mark Knopfler. Let's use that bit.
Right.
Right.
Interesting.
So that's how it's evolved.
Cool. Have you ever had a chance to meet him?
No, I have not.
Have you been to a Clapton concert?
I have not.
You've seen enough of those on TV and DVD.
I see a lot of, as a matter of fact, I see so much of my own film.
Yeah. And the other thing, Bill, is you can't sit there in front of a live concert and pause it.
And yeah, say, and analyze.
Do that bar again.
What was that? Rewind. Span. Stop. You know, I hear you. Now, you've met Eric.
Yeah, I did. I was a resident ligger at a studio in the UK.
You're going to have to give me another term for that.
Like office furniture. I'd just show up there and hang out because I had nothing else to do when I was playing.
Okay.
And it was a wonderful studio. It was owned by a guy called Nigel Gray, who produced the first two Police albums, mm-hmm. did a lot of work with Wishbone Ash, and great stuff through the 70s and 80s. And it was about 1977, 78, about the time I got arrested for the radio. I was in the coffee lounge at the back of the studio, just minding my own business, playing guitar. And jazz fingerstyle, I think I was playing. And anyway, he'd been in the recording studio with Gary Brooker of Procol Harum, and they were doing this project. And nobody was allowed in the studio while it was going on. So I sat out back, and he walked in there, went over to the TV, cranked the volume up, and put the horse racing on. I thought, that's a bit rude, I can't hear what I'm playing. So I cranked it up a bit.
Well, that's a little rude. He's trying to hear the race.
And he said, "Oi, can you shut up? I've got 10 grand on this race." I said, "Well, I'm terribly sorry. I didn't realize that my guitar playing was disturbing the horses." Well, I thought the bottle of Courvoisier in his hand was going to make contact with my forehead.
That was a great line, though.
I was really scared. So I walked away and went home that day.
That was pretty funny. I met him in L.A. at a session. A buddy of mine invited me, Lauren Harriet out in L.A. invited me to a session, and we just got to walk in, hang out for like 10 minutes, and then walk out, you know. And then when they went to lunch, we heard him do a track and play it back in the studio, and it was him and, Marcus Miller, Steve Gadd,
wow.
and Greg Fillinganes, just the four of them.
What a stable.
And they did a track, and they were listening back, and then on the way out, I think it was Greg's birthday, because I didn't know this about Eric, but he makes or made jewelry. This would have been around 2001, I think. And he gave Greg a bracelet that he'd made for him for his birthday. And I thought that was pretty cool. So, but it's always fun to hear those masters play, you know. And they're doing it all wrong. They're all in one room. The drums, the guitar amps, blankets over them, a B3 cabinet with blankets over it, you know. And it's like, this is how they make the big records, you know. Just
yeah,
like
in your garage, that's how you get the energy.
Yeah, you know, just all together in a space. So that's kind of cool.
I was recording in a studio in London. With it was the Island Studio in St. Peter Square, and it's just like one big room, and everything's separated by sofas. So that's how they do their sound dampening. So
whatever it takes, is get one mic pointed one way and one mic pointed the other way, and stuff in between them. You know,
If it's a good room, the room has its own ambiance.
You can get away with it. We're going to talk about how to say a word.
Nosy Bert.
Because it's the title of one of your songs, and we don't know how to say this word.
I'm not sure.
Trebizond.
Trebizond.
Yeah, what is that?
Trebizond. It's the ancient name for a city on the spice route to Asia.
Ooh.
In Turkey. Currently, it's not called that anymore. It's called Trabzon. But I assume we're going to be playing a song. And
yeah, I'd like to play that track.
Yeah. for some reason, this song for me brought the emotion of sailing on a ship and turning around a peninsula and coming upon an ancient walled city.
Interesting.
And I thought, I need to find an ancient walled city to name this song after.
Interesting.
And that's where it came from.
That's awesome. And this was cut, what, a couple years back, a few years back? How long ago was this?
Yeah, this is 2007.
Okay. Awesome. And Simon's laughing and pointing at notes or something.
I can't believe you had to look that up.
I'm really bad with dates.
I live day to day, baby. I got
to
do that too. All right, so let's
what
check
year
it out.
Is it?
How do you say it?
Trebizond.
Okay, and Simon was arguing it was a Portuguese word or Scottish word.
Cornish word. Trebizond. It's out of an Enid Blyton story.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go with Bill's. I think that sounds cooler. So Trebizond.
Absolutely.
Here on the Otto D Show from Bill Garvin.
Listening to Auto D. coming at you live.
And that was Trey Bazan here on the Otto D Show from Bill Garvin. I think I said that right this time. I can't.
Close enough.
Close enough.
Nobody really knows how it's pronounced.
Yeah,
unless
right.
You're Turkish.
There you go. There you go. And that's a very different than the other track we played.
Absolutely. That's more smooth jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so have you got some favorite smooth jazz records or artists? Or where did that come from?
I don't know where that came from. Okay. I had this concept at one point. My career was going to be smooth jazz with a Stevie Ray Vaughan influence.
Right. So and smooth, then, but with an edge.
Yeah, with
not
a little
that smooth.
With a little blues, it's got to have blues, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
But smooth jazz just disappeared.
It did, didn't
all
it?
Of a sudden. I still love it. I mean, Rippington's. That's kind mm-hmm. of a Rippington's kind of feel yeah. on that song, and I love those guys.
Yeah.
You know.
Very cool. Are there some places you've always wanted to play?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely love to tour Europe. I never have had the opportunity, and I would love to do that.
With this band?
With this band. I think this band deserves it. Mm-hmm. You know, we've put a lot of hard work in it. We've got a lot of very talented people, so it's all about having the contacts.
Yeah.
And Simon's going to get me there, he says, right?
I'll get you there, baby boy. Don't you worry about it.
He's got a guy in England who can get you in a club.
Yeah.
So if he can get you that far, you just
For £5 a person, right?
It's on free beer.
I don't even know what a quid is.
That's 50 pence and free Coke all night, mate.
Oh, right.
Hey, careful. So how about previous shows? Was there one that really stood out that was something special you recall?
Oh, we've had a lot of great shows. Mm-hmm. We've played a lot of these big venues in the RV parks. People aren't aware of those as a venue, but there really are some fantastic amphitheaters and such and some
really
of the, in the mm-hmm. RV parks. We've done some casino gigs that have mm-hmm. been very nice. One that stands out. No, I love it every time this band gets an opportunity to play.
Mm-hmm. Have you had an opportunity to take this band and do your original material?
No, that was, okay, my master plan back when I started this was, I'm going to have this Eric Clapton band and have it be an instant success because everybody loves Eric Clapton, and I'm going to segue that to my original music. Well, the instant success is, it's still 5 years, it's not so instant anymore.
I will fix that, Bill.
All right, good.
It's tough. Yeah, you can get one of your own songs all over the radio and TV just constantly, then you got a shot at it. Short of that, I don't know how you can make that happen. So good luck with that. Well, listen, so coming up on Saturday,
BLK Live, baby.
In Scottsdale?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah, it looks like a really, really interesting venue.
And it really holds a lot of people, so I think everybody will be able to get a ticket at the door if they haven't gotten one. There should be plenty of space.
I only accepted the gig because of the potential of bikinis.
Well, my violinist says, she's like, you're kidding, a pool, I can jump in the water from the stage. And I'm like, you can try. I don't know how far it'll really be, but it should be a lot of fun. It's an all ages show, so you can bring the family and jump in the swimming pool. In fact, I think the promotion from the venue even says, you know, bring your swimming suits. So that's kind of interesting. It'll be the first of many, maybe. So what's coming up after that?
After that, I do a lot of duo work, and after that is a lot of trout fishing throughout the West, because I take most of the summer off and get the heck out of this furnace.
It gets a little warm. Well, Bill, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
It was fun to listen to the stuff and chat. Thanks for bringing this young gentleman around, Simon.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Bill.
We'll get you in again sometime, Simon, where we can hear the rest of your stories.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll probably do that one pre-recorded so we can
edit things out. So
edit.
I will see both of you guys on Saturday.
Fantastic.
Well, come on out to BLK and check out the show, everybody.